Welcome to the Compass Christian Church Weekly Sermon Podcast. For more information, visit us at compasslew.org.
Good morning. Good morning. It's good to see you all. Today we are continuing in our sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount, and we are walking through a section that we're calling Fulfilling the Law. And a few weeks ago, Will introduced this section and talked a little bit about how in this sermon, Jesus is especially concerned with making it clear that he's not teaching against the Old Testament law. He's coming on the scene as a new rabbi. He's gaining followers. And the scribes and Pharisees of the day are specifically interested in one thing, right? Are you for the law or are you against the law, Jesus? And Jesus comes down solidly on the side of being for the law. It's just not in the way that the scribes and Pharisees would like it to be. In fact, Jesus was calling, as Paula mentioned earlier, he was calling his followers to a greater righteousness than the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. We talked a lot about how that term righteousness is kind of a loaded term. Like, we use it a lot in church culture. Paul uses it a lot in his letters. And you really have to figure out what Jesus meant by righteousness when he used it. And the way that he's using it is something along the lines of doing right by God and doing right by people, as we talked about. And what Jesus is saying is that there's a greater way of doing right by God than through a checklist, kind of the scribes and Pharisees' way of doing right by God and doing right by people. So this is what Jesus is calling them to, this greater righteousness. The past 2 weeks, we heard from Megan and Pastor Will on the topics of murder, lust, and divorce. Some intense topics there, as Paula mentioned. I want to thank them for getting the hard ones out of the way for me. What these three topics have in common, as I think Paula mentioned as well, is that they're the culmination of a process that starts with dehumanization. That's kind of the thread that runs between those three topics. We talked about how if we want to live by Jesus's greater righteousness, it's not enough to just not murder someone, right? We need to labor with the Spirit to root out anger, contentment, insults, things like that. It's not enough to just not commit adultery, right? Congratulations, you didn't commit adultery. We must labor with the Spirit to root out lust and objectification that are at the core of that. It's not enough to just make sure that you include a certificate of divorce when you send your wife away for no reason. We must labor with the Spirit in our marriages as equal image bearers. He's calling us to that greater righteousness. This week, we're starting a new set of three examples of this greater righteousness. And while the common thread that went between the last three was dehumanization, these next 3 weeks are going to cover conflict in our relationships. So let's pick up here in Matthew chapter 5, verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil." All right, by a show of hands, I want to know who took an oath this past week. Okay. How about this past month? Okay, let the record show, no one raised their hand. So we're good, everyone's following Jesus. We can pack it up and go home. Worship team, can come up. Obviously I'm kidding. But what I want to point out is that this is one of those rare cases where Jesus says something that is provocative that doesn't actually sound like much of a challenge to us. You know, Jesus telling us that everyone who is angry with his brother is liable to judgment, like that is challenging to me, right? But Jesus telling us not to swear oaths at all, like that might get a little weird if I ever have to go to court, but it doesn't seem super challenging right up front. But what I want to tell you is that these words of Jesus would have been absolutely shocking to his audience and provocative. Just as shocking as Jesus telling us to not be angry is to us. And the reason why is because oaths were an integral part of the flourishing of their society. So there's no way around it. Like, we're not in their society. We have to take some time to learn about the practice of oaths as they would have experienced it in their culture. And then what we have to do is we have to figure out what the wisdom is behind that and how we can apply Jesus' words to us. So we're going to do that as we walk through this section verse by verse. So let's go back to verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. We've also talked about in previous sermons how when Jesus says, again, you've heard that it was said, that what he's doing is he's quoting Old Testament scripture. And this is actually the first time in this series so far that he's not quoting it directly. What he's doing is he's taking three or more scriptures about this topic and kind of forming a summary sentence about that. So he's doing this with scriptures like Leviticus chapter 19, verse 12, which says, you shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. Also doing this with scriptures like Numbers chapter 30, verse 2, which says, if a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Also, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 21 through 23, which says, if you make a vow to Yahweh your God, you shall not delay in fulfilling it, for Yahweh your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You shall be careful to do what has passed from past your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to Yahweh your God what you have promised with your mouth. I want to take a side note here and just talk about what oaths and vows are. These terms are sometimes used interchangeably, but in the Bible, the way that they're used throughout the Old Testament is that a vow is typically a promise that you make to God. So you're saying, God, if you do this for me, I will do this for you. That's a vow. And then an oath is a promise that is made to another person. I think we're all familiar with these terms in one form or another. It's actually inverted the way that we use these terms. So we talk about marriage vows. You're vowing to another person. That's the opposite of the Bible's meaning. We also are familiar with being under oath, swearing to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God, right? I didn't realize it, but when you do that in court, you're actually supposed to be doing that to God. And so again, that's the opposite. That would be a vow in the Old Testament. We call it an oath. Now, both of these are in scope for these verses. We just saw Jesus is combining these three verses that talk about both of these things, oaths and vows. But I really think Jesus' focus here is specifically on oaths, because it's in the context of conflict with each other in relationships and promises that you make to each other. Okay, so now that we've learned some background, let's do a thought exercise. I want you all to imagine that you're a first century Israelite. You're in the market for a new table for your house. Your old one's worn down. You want a nice, beautiful, new wood one. It's going to go perfect with your Passover Seder meal. Now, your neighbor happens to be a carpenter. So you go and talk to him to see if he can build one for you. It's a super nice guy. His name's Jesus. He seems trustworthy. So Jesus, the carpenter, agrees to build you a table. But he asks for 50% of the cost up front to cover his materials. Right? It's not unreasonable. He says that he'll build you a table in a week, and you can come pick it up and then pay him the rest of the money. It's kind of a common business deal that we might make. My question is, how do you make this deal? How do you have the confidence that he's going to hold up his end of the deal? He's going to build you the table and not just run away with your money, right? Other than the fact that he's the Son of God. But of course, the first thing you would do is you'd call up your lawyer. You'd have him draft you up a contract. Should be simple. It's like standard language. You could always take him to court and sue him if he doesn't build you the table, right? Well, maybe you'd pay with your credit card. And then if you needed to, you could file a dispute with your credit card company. They would investigate, like, make sure you get your money back, right? If all else fails, you could maybe file a complaint with the Better Business Bureau. Or worse, you could leave Jesus a bad Yelp review. That would surely hurt his carpentry business. I doubt he'd recover from that. He'd probably have to go find something else to do. But my point is, if you were a first century Israelite, you would do exactly none of these things. This was a totally verbal culture, and their economy revolved around language, and it was critical that you be able to trust people in your dealings. You had to take people at their word. Without contracts, bank accounts, security cameras, their entire economy and culture was built on the reliability of people's words. And in this culture and economy, oaths were a real tool that provided real leverage and confidence. Here's how they would work. If you were the carpenter taking someone's money, promising to return them something, you might say, "I swear by the name of Yahweh that I will build this table for you, as we agreed." And if you were the person putting down that deposit, you'd hear that oath. You'd know Leviticus 19, verse 12, which says, "You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of your God." And so you'd think, like, wow, this person must really mean what they're saying because they're willing to invite God's judgment on them if they don't follow through. And in a world where they actually believe in the supernatural, like, this is a real thing that gave people real confidence. And we actually see this in Hebrews chapter 6, verse 16. It says, "For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation." So it's a real tool, provided real leverage, very important to the fabric of their society. And we just don't have this in our society. Isn't this super useful? Like, what a handy provision that God provided in the law to help encourage honesty. So let's move on to verse 34. So Jesus says, "But I say to you, do not take an oath at all." We're going to stop there. So what, like, we just got done showing how critical oaths are, how they're super useful for ensuring the truth, and Jesus just says to be done with them in one sentence. And what he's doing here is he's not opposing the Old Testament teaching, but what he is doing is he's telling them to opt out of an option that the law provided. This is not unlike his teaching on an unjustified divorce that Will briefly covered last week. Our friend R.T. France, who's a scholar on the book of Matthew, he describes these divorce and oath laws similarly. What he says is that these are laws that aim to control human failure. Laws that aim to control human failure. Later on in the book of Matthew, Jesus talks about divorce, and he says that the law allowed them to divorce their wives because of the hardness of their hearts. And I think we can understand that somewhat, but, like, why is Jesus telling them to not take up this option of oaths? Like, it's not immediately clear to us why he's doing that, so we have to figure out what was wrong with oaths as they were doing it in their time. Let's keep reading. "But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. What I mentioned before was that people would use the name of Yahweh and then be bound to that oath at risk of divine judgment. Well, by the time we get to Jesus, this is 1,000 years or more after Moses. Like, the way he describes this is, he says, you've heard that it was said to people of old. Like, we think of Moses and Jesus of kind of being similar time frames maybe, but he's talking about someone that was 1,000 years removed from their culture. So by the time we get to Jesus, a funny thing happened. In an attempt to avoid profaning the name of God, they just stopped saying the name of God, like totally stopped using the name of God. Like that's one way to avoid judgment, is just don't use the name of God at all, right? And this like left a vacuum in this practice of oaths, because it's all about using God's name, inviting judgment on yourself, and someone can trust what you're saying because you're willing to do that. So when they took oaths in Jesus' day, they weren't swearing by the name of Yahweh anymore. They would instead swear by Yahweh adjacent things like the heavens or the earth or Jerusalem or the temple itself. These are all glorious things, just like God. What better way to show someone that I'm serious? And you know what? Like, side benefit of that is if I can't actually follow through, like, I didn't actually swear on the name of Yahweh, right? It's perfect. It's like the ancient version of making a promise, but crossing your fingers behind your back, right? So do you see the issue with that now? Jesus sure did, and in these verses, he's pointing out how this strategy is like an exercise in missing the point. You think that you can avoid God's judgment by swearing by heaven? Yeah, heaven is God's throne. You think you can avoid God's judgment by swearing by the earth? The earth is his footstool. You think you can avoid God's judgment by swearing by Jerusalem? That's his city. Okay, you think you can avoid God's judgment by swearing by your head. Like, it's your head. It's not God's. It's yours. Well, you got me there. Except you don't even have control over your own head. What Jesus keenly realized is that at the core of the system of oaths as it was used in their day was manipulation. And he's saying that manipulation has no place in his kingdom. You can't just leave God out of it by invoking his name, because every person, or by not invoking his name, because every person that you're manipulating is made in the image of God. And if you think that you can manipulate God's image bearers and avoid his judgment because of a, quote, technicality, then you're truly missing the point of the law. That's living by the checklist righteousness and not the greater righteousness. Our friend Dallas Willard puts it nicely in his book, The Divine Conspiracy. What he says is, but Jesus goes right to the heart of why people swear oaths. He knew that they do it to impress others with their sincerity and reliability and thus gain acceptance of what they are saying and what they want. It is a method for getting their way. They are declaring some promise or purpose or some point of information or knowledge dear to them. They want their hearers to accept what they say and do what they want. So they say, by God, or God knows, to lend weight to their words and presence. It is simply a device of manipulation designed to override the judgment and will of the ones they are focusing upon, to push them aside rather than respecting them and leaving their decision and action strictly up to them. So Jesus tells them not to take up this option of using oaths that the law gave them. But like, how are you supposed to influence others and make deals without that in Jesus' time? You know, we don't I think about how we don't use oaths today, really. We use them in court sometimes. But I think about politics and business and the media. Like they might not outright call it manipulation, but the core purpose of marketing, advertising, influencers, political debates, all of these things is to some degree to get people to do what you want them to do. It's just ingrained in our culture. So while we are swimming in this culture, Jesus says that this type of manipulation has absolutely no place in our relationships. He wants us to opt out of this system of manipulation and treat every person with respect by letting them use the free will that God gave them. So what does Jesus say is the alternative to this manipulation? Let's go to verse 37. He says, "Let what you say be simply yes or no." That's it. Yes or no. What difference would this make? Let's play this out with the last situation that we talked about. Or actually a different situation. Let's imagine you want to borrow your friend's donkey. You ask him if you can borrow his donkey for a day, and he says no. Under the system of oaths, you could simply swear by the name of Yahweh, or you could swear by, I guess in Jesus' day, you have to swear by the temple or the city of Jerusalem, and maybe he relents and he lets you borrow his donkey. So you got what you wanted. That's great. But if you, like as a follower of Jesus, what you would have to do is you'd have to face that no that your friend says. You don't try to override it by borrowing from God's honor. That other person is a fellow image bearer with their own judgment and will. What you might have to do instead is like have an actual vulnerable conversation with that person. You might find out that they're reluctant to lend you their donkey because maybe they lent you some tools a while ago and you didn't take care of them, and maybe you find out they don't see you as a responsible person. You might have to say, "I know that you can't trust me, but I'm asking you to give me one more chance." I think back to what Pastor Will talked about when he said that he wants us to expand our imagination of what life can be like. So what does this say about Jesus's view of what humanity can be like? About how we can treat each other with respect and communicate with honesty and transparency. This is definitely not easier. Don't get me wrong. Discovering that someone views you as irresponsible and not getting what you want, like that hurts. That can be painful. But you can't truly repair that relationship without realizing that there's rupture there in the first place. And you need to root out selfishness and manipulation and replace it with honesty and transparency in our interactions in order to do that. All right, so we kind of talked about this a little bit, but let's talk about how this applies to us. As I mentioned before, we don't have oaths in our culture to this same degree that they did, right? We can just rely on the contract or the Google review or, your credit filing a credit card dispute to kind of resolve these things. There's like these backstops for trust. So I think there are two ways that we can think about applying this section of Scripture. The first is that Jesus is calling us to prioritize simple honesty and transparency. Pastor Rich Velotis, that Will talked about a few weeks ago, he talks about this in his book on the Sermon on the Mount. It's called The Narrow Path. And he talks about how one of the things that challenges us in this culture is we might not have oaths, but we live in a culture of superficiality, a very superficial culture. This is a culture that chooses and often values like skimming right along the surface of our interaction. Like it's too risky to go too far below the surface, right? You might find out there's conflict there or something else. So we just tend to skim right along the surface. And in this culture, politeness and not making waves in our personal interactions can often be valued above honesty, transparency, and vulnerability. To me, one of the places where this is most apparent is at my work. I work in a pretty corporate job. If you join a meeting on Monday, you hear, "Happy Monday, how was your week?" There's kind of a standard canned answer, "It was good." On Friday, you hear, "Happy Friday" in your meetings. There's kind of just a lot of skimming along the surface there. This past week, I was in Washington, D.C. for some work travel. I was doing like a training class. And when I got there, I found out that someone that I had worked with on a project last year was doing the same training as me. And that project that we worked on, my team was trying to get one thing done and her team was trying to get something else done. And they kind of like the things we were trying to do kind of butted heads with each other. There's a little bit of like conflict there. We weren't going after the same thing. And I kind of sensed there was some tension there. Like it wasn't huge, but you know how you can just kind of sense that sometimes. And it was enough that I wasn't really really sure how things stood between me and this person. And like also complicating this was the fact that all of our previous interactions had been virtual, and it's the first time I'm meeting this person like actually face to face. And when I met her, she greeted me with this kind of dry tone. She was like, "Hi, John, it's good to see you." And "it's good to see you" is just something that everyone says, right? It doesn't really mean anything anymore. And so I just really had no idea what this meant. I didn't know if there was any tension or conflict there below the surface. And that's kind of my point with this culture of superficiality. Like, it's so common in our culture for people to regularly say things that we don't actually mean. Like, think about how crazy that is. We like regularly say things we don't actually mean. And it makes it such that we don't really believe people when they say nice things. It's hard to tell what is actually nice and what is just someone being superficial or being polite. And this culture of superficiality, it ultimately breeds dishonesty and distrust. And it's all under the guise of being polite. You know, I think we do this in church too. I think it's most prevalent in our culture. But even in church, like it's tempting to do this, to skim right along the surface as if everything's okay and communicate that way when really there's conflict or tension living underneath. And I think what Jesus wants us to do is to be honest with ourselves and to be honest with each other about what the truth is, what is actually, like what the situation is like and what is actually there. Pastor Rich Velotis talks about a similar phenomenon to this that also affects our church culture, albeit with a different reason behind it. And what he says is, in his book, The Narrow Path, he says, quote, "In some environments, especially Christian circles, honesty and truth-telling feel too risky. Sadly, our vision of discipleship leaves no room for bad days. In the church, it's common to see mental health conditions such as depression as a sin. It's also common to assign moral judgment to seasons of pain. And of course, many people don't feel safe disclosing intimate parts of their lives to people who don't offer a loving presence. This is tragic. Communities that foster untruth are not sustainable and life-giving." I love this line at the end right here. Communities that foster untruth are not sustainable and life-giving. Church, if we want to be a sustainable and life-giving community, we have to foster the truth in our interactions with each other. This means that we need to be vulnerable and honest when things aren't going well, when we aren't doing well, when our relationships aren't doing well. And we need to welcome the truth that others speak to us. I think that's a really key part of it. You can't just give out truth. You have to be willing to accept truth, even if it's hard. So I would encourage all of us to expand our our imagination for how a community can encourage and embrace honesty and transparency and deal with those hard things, including conflict. The second way that I think we can apply this is more through the lens of manipulation. One question that I think we can all ask ourselves, and I promise I will explain this, the question I think we can ask ourselves is, how might I be using God's honor to manipulate and override the judgment of others? I have an example of this that I wanted to share. I think it was over 10 years ago now, but like over 10 years ago, I knew a woman who was getting some counseling from her pastor, and her pastor felt like he needed to send a strong message to this lady. And he wanted to send a message to her about certain areas in her life that she needed to change. And he proceeded to talk for quite a while. And what the young lady shared afterwards was that he had actually said a lot of deeply hurtful things to her. But the most impactful thing that he had said, which was actually the thing he said right before he said those hurtful things, was, "God told me to say this to you." Talk about using God's honor. That young lady couldn't believe that the loving God that she knew would want him to say such hurtful things to her. But that interaction started her down a path that eventually led to her walking away from the faith altogether. I think this is particularly challenging because I know I believe, and I think a lot of us believe, that God really does speak to people today. He really does give you things to say to other people. He gives you things about your own life. But I think the key here is that if you're claiming to speak on God's behalf, you have to realize that it's really easy to override others' judgment with that claim. It's kind of pulling the God card, right? God told me this, so we have to listen to this because this is what God is saying. And this is especially a risk if you're in a position of power or leadership relative to that person, like the example I was sharing. I think there is a way where you can share what you believe God is telling you, but also welcome input from others, respecting them, and then leaving their decisions and actions up to them. I think one way that we do this here at Compass really well is we encourage discernment during our open prayer and worship time. You know, when someone prophesies, they're claiming to speak on behalf of God. That is a big claim. Talk about adding weight to your words. This is why it's so important that we practice discernment. And you'll hear Pastor Paula mention it all the time, like she did just a few minutes ago. All right, let's finish up verse 37. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Some other translations render this last phrase here as the evil one. And the general scholarly consensus is that this is most likely referring to Satan, the devil. And this sounds pretty intense, right? Like, is this just Jesus using hyperbole like he does sometimes? Or can we take this at face value? What I want you to do is to think back to the Genesis story of the Garden of Eden. In Genesis 1 and 2, God creates Adam and Eve and places them in the garden to work and keep it. He tells them that they can eat of any tree in the garden except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then he tells them that they will die if they eat of this tree. Then in Genesis chapter 3, along comes the snake. And what does he tell them? Well, the first thing that he says is in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. The second half of that verse says, "He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And what he's doing here is he's quoting God, but he's adding the word "not," right? And later on, he actually inverts God's words and tells them that they will not actually die when God tells them that they would die. So what is he doing here? He's taking God's honor and God's words, and he's using them to manipulate Adam and Eve to do what he wants them to do. This is the same manipulation that we've seen at the core of oaths that, as practiced in Jesus' day. The original purpose of oaths and vows was to bolster the truth. One thing that the Bible Project points out in their podcast on these verses is that if you actually go through the Old Testament and you look at the records of oaths and vows, what you'll see overwhelmingly is that the way that they are used ends up actually bringing death and suffering far more often than it is used to bolster the truth. You have examples like Jephthah, who in Judges 11 makes a vow with God. He says, God, if you give me victory over the Ammonites, I will sacrifice as a burnt offering the first thing that comes through my door when I get home. And then his daughter, his only child, walks through the door to greet him when he comes home. Like, what a stupid vow, right? And then you have Saul in 1 Samuel 14. He's also trying to win a military battle. He makes an oath with all of his soldiers. He tells them that whoever eats food will be cursed that day. But his son Jonathan is off and doesn't hear this oath and eats some honey. And this leads to Saul chasing after and trying to kill his own son. They're trying to get what they want by way of these oaths and vows, and it ends up just returning right back on them, bringing death and suffering. In our culture, dishonesty and manipulation are so commonplace, and at times it seems like they're the only way to get things done. I know that's how politics seems right now. But Jesus wants his followers to be clear that wherever there is dishonesty or manipulation, there's something diabolical going on under the surface that we might not be aware of. So once again, I want to encourage you to expand your imagination for what life can be like in light of what Jesus has shared with us in these verses. Imagine a community of people who opt out of the dishonesty, manipulation, and superficiality of our culture and speak the truth to each other in love. Imagine a community of people who welcome honesty and vulnerability from others with a loving presence, even when those words might implicate us. Finally, imagine a community that lives well in the tension between sharing what they believe God has revealed to them and respecting, not overriding, the judgment and will of others. Let's pray. Almighty God, I praise you and thank you for the wisdom that your Son has shared in these verses. God, I know that we're in a place as a culture where dishonesty and manipulation are so commonplace, we don't even recognize it at sometimes. We can just be numb to it. Sometimes it seems like there's nothing we can trust or nowhere we can turn without being influenced or marketed to. But God, we know that you are truly trustworthy. We know that your yes is a yes and your no is a no. We are so thankful for that. And we ask that you would help us bring that simplicity to our own interactions as a community, God. We ask that you would help us address conflict in our relationships with love and respect as it arises. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the Compass Christian Church Weekly Sermon Podcast. For more information on how we are striving to follow Jesus together here in Louisville, Kentucky, check out our website, compasslou.org, where you can subscribe to our newsletter and view additional resources.